Straight Talk from Israel.
You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio.
Welcome to Beyond the Matrix here on Israel News Talk Radio. Unplug, strap yourself in, because you are about to move beyond the matrix.
You have moved beyond the matrix. I am Rod Bryant, your illustrious host here on Israel News Talk Radio. Thank you for joining me each week here on Israel News Talk Radio. I have a great host, co-host with me today. You'll know him very well in just a moment when I introduce him. But we're going to be talking about a very, very important subject, sort of give you a big, broad picture of what's going on in Iran and protests, bringing clarity to the protests in Iran that started about around December the 28th. At some point, most people think it's down the chute and nothing's going on right now, but this has been a very interesting protest compared to past protests. And we're just going to open up the book on it and sort of examine it. If you would like to send us an email, we'd love to hear from you. Rod@IsraelNewsTalkRadio.com. Rod@IsraelNewsTalkRadio.com. Love to hear your suggestions on what you would like us to do a show on or concentrate on. And then next week or the week after, sometime around there, we're going to be bringing in, or actually going to tease, subject matter that I think that you, this is going to be probably one of the most important shows that you'll hear. In a moment, my guest, Jerry Gordon, and I will be sort of teasing about what that subject matter is. Jerry, how are you doing today?
I'm doing fine.
Good, good. You've recovered from your surgery. You look great. The additional horns that they added, I thought found that's kind of a little strange that you would have them surgically attach horns to your head.
Well, that, you know, Moses has horns, too. That's because he had the benefit of looking upon Hashem.
The Holy One, blessed be he.
Correct.
Okay. Okay. Well, we have a great show. We're going to be talking about Iran. We're going to be talking about the protest. We're going to be comparing the protest with past protests and what makes this different from the others. So if you're going to be listening this hour, don't turn it off. As a matter of fact, do me a favor. We're getting ready to go into a news break. While you're listening to the news, grab you a cup of tea, call a couple of friends, let them know that we're on the air here on Israel News Talk Radio. And we're going to be talking about Iran and its protest. And what does that mean for the rest of the world around us? You are listening to Beyond the Matrix here on IsraelNewsTalkRadio.com.
Israel is located in one of the most volatile areas in the world. Israel is an island of stability in a sea of war and unrest. In the midst of this turmoil, Israel stands out as a beacon of order and human progress. Each week we update you on what's happening in this, the Jewish state, a true light unto the nations. This is Jay Shapiro. Join me every Thursday on Israel News Talk Radio.
Welcome back to Beyond the Matrix, here on Israel News Talk Radio.
Thank you so much for joining us here on Beyond the Matrix. I'm Rod Bryant, along with my guest, Jerry Gordon. And Jerry and I often take time during a month, at least once a month, sometimes twice a month. I think this month we might do it. Well, no, it'll be next month, that we're going to do another show dedicated on a very interesting subject that we're only going to tease until the end of the hour. So I want to make you listen for the whole hour to find out what interesting show that we have. Both he and I come from a military background. I'm a combat veteran, so I understand tactics. He also has been in field operations. So we're going to bring you a sort of a big picture. I think it'll be really interesting. Jerry, in this week's show, I wanted to concentrate on the protest. I mean, right after we did our last show last month, Iran, you know, popped up with a giant protest. Now, this is not the first time that you and I have seen a protest in Iran. As a matter of fact, the one that I remember the greatest was when I was a young boy. I like to say that. It makes myself feel young. was the Iranian protest that ended up landing many of our embassy personnel in danger for many, many months until finally they were let out after Carter administration lost the election and then Ronald Reagan won. So what? Let's first build up and talk about what was this protest? What did it look like first?
Well, this protest was radically different than the 2009 protest that was against the fraudulent election of Mohammed Ahmadinejad, who, of course, was a fraudster to begin with. That was largely focused in Tehran, and it was the elite, and it was the support of the so-called green or reformist movement inside the Islamic movement. This time, it's not. It was the average working guy and gal throughout the country in more than 80 cities. I mean, by the time the thing began to peter out this past week, they'd arrested about 3,700 folks, and I think a couple of hundred might have been killed. But it was different this time because these people said, hey, you cut a deal with the world on the nuclear pact, and you didn't deliver for us, the people that you're supposed to be supporting, supreme ruler, meaning Ayatollah Khamenei. They wanted to see something in their paychecks, essentially, the ability to buy things that they couldn't do before. And the vast majority of the population is, particularly those, you know, 50% or better of the population is under the age of 24, let alone 30.
Wow. Didn't
and their
know that.
Their unemployment rate is three times. It's nearly 30% versus the roughly average of 12.8% for Iran's labor force in general. And then they've had hyperinflation.
Right.
Ahmadinejad, when he was in there, created a whole bunch of phony baloney. Madoff, in fact, they called it Abu Madoff financial institutions.
I didn't know that.
To build, you know, another construction boom, and that blew up in the face of it, and it resulted in the regime having to sort of begin a partial bailout. But the worst part about it is those hundreds of billions of dollars of sequestered oil revenues.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of that went to fund two things: adventures overseas in places like Lebanon and Syria, Yemen, you name it, the Persian Gulf. And it also diverted funds to what are called religious foundations. That and the Revolutionary Guard, who own a whole bunch of businesses, some of which are sanctioned because of the missile sanctions that we've created. So it didn't trickle down. You know, this is an example of Islamic trickle-down economic theory.
Right.
It just did not work. And so therefore, they blew up. That was one aspect of it. The other aspect of it was the use of a certain kind of messaging service called Telegram that is encrypted. And Telegram was used as the sort of tissue connection between these average persons across the country. They could send messages saying death to the dictator, meaning Ayatollah Khamenei. They say get out of Lebanon, Yemen,
Jerry,
name it, get out of Syria.
This Telegram is an app for their phone? Is that what it is, or tablet?
It's basically a messaging service.
Okay.
You and I happen to use another app. It's called WhatsApp.
Right.
And we message back and forth, and supposedly that's encrypted. Some other people say Signal is better. But Telegram was developed by a Russian, and he left Russia because he wanted this to be used throughout the world by people like the ordinary Iranians who are using it. What's interesting is the comparison with 2009 was in 2009, there were less than 1 million. This is a country of 80 million.
Mm-hmm.
But in 2009, there were less than 1 million smartphones.
Wow.
Guess how many there are now? 48 to 50 million.
So the whole point is everybody has a smartphone nowadays.
Right.
Which changes the dynamic of a grassroots protest.
That's correct.
Right.
Now, interestingly, the so-called moderate president, Rouhani, at one point this past week said, well, it's okay to protest. And then he said the reason for it is they found that the Telegram was being used as a messaging service for something like 10,000 businesses across the country legitimately for commercial reasons, and they were going to kill it. So they are consternated. They finally realized that there's been a real substantive social media revolution in their own country, right, that allowed the ordinary folks to say, get out of Dodge, meaning right, get out of, you know, where? Hezbollah or Yemen or mm-hmm. Syria. Because they view that as the bad use of the released sanctions fund that could have been used to invest in real jobs and real growth.
Right. Now, let me
add, they're not doing that.
Let me add just a little bit of clarity, because if I'm not mistaken, you can correct me, but sure, the Iranian oil companies are owned by Iran themselves, correct?
Yes, that's correct.
And so that means that all the profits could go to the Iranian government. And different from, say, Saudi Arabia, in which just about every Saudi citizen gets some type of reparations from, or what do you call it, enumerations?
They get a subsidy.
Subsidy, right, from right, the government because of the sale yep, of the oil, which yep, means that most Saudis, I don't even know if they work. I mean, honestly, I don't even think that they work, because the only people you see working are Filipinos and foreigners. From different parts of the country.
The average Saudi is called of a certain class, is called a sitting around boy.
Yeah.
They don't have very much to do. That's part of their problem.
Right. And so in Iran, they should be able to be receiving some funds, and knowing that our economy should be bursting at the seams when we are struggling, and we shouldn't be struggling with the amount of oil sales that's going on in the nation of Iran. And so that, coupled with the fact that the economy's not going and not doing very well, that the people are still struggling, and they realize that Iran is spending millions or hundreds of millions of dollars to support terrorism, this protest is different because they want this stuff to stop. It's
That's
not
correct.
Now, it's
yeah,
not part of a specific political organization, is it?
No, it's not. And that's one of the difficulties. The commentator, good guy, John Spire in Israel, has a piece this weekend on what made this thing sort of different than the episode in 2009. And he points out that there isn't a revolutionary government as there was that precipitated the 1979 revolution under the original founder, the bad guy, Ayatollah Khomeini. And that raises the question about whether or not there should be support for a government in exile, as there was during World War II. You know, when we had the Nazis, we had a Norwegian government, Czech government, a Dutch government, et cetera, in exile in London. Well, there isn't anything of that nature. The only personality out there who there could be coalescence about is the late Shah's son
yeah,
who has the same name as the founder, Reza Pahlavi. And he lives in the States. I think he lives up in the D.C. area.
Right.
So he was interviewed. And he says, you know, he'd really like to see a pluralistic government and economy.
Mm-hmm.
And there were cries amongst the protesters of bring back the Shah, meaning bring back the kid.
Right.
And he could be an iconic figure around which a, quote, government in exile, if Iranians could deal with each other, essentially could be formed. That is what John Spire said in his Jerusalem Post op-ed the other day. Basically was a missing component that would put real meat behind the stuff. The other is something that the U.S. could do, and that is reform its Voice of America Farsi or Persian language service to generate, you know, the kind of commentary. Ironically, it's the Kol Israel Radio's Farsi service is the most listened to by Iranians.
Right, right.
So there's that aspect of it. So you take those couple of items I just enumerated that others have sort of logged on to, and you can see that there's something that's missing that could be developed if there was a concerted effort on the part of other governments. And the other is, quite frankly, that half of the population of Iran is not Iranian. They're not Persian. You know, they're Arab,
right?
Or they're Baluchs, or they're Lurs, or they're Azeris, or the Kurds. Don't forget the Kurds.
And we'll be talking about that later on. As a matter of fact, if you talk to an Iranian, they're going to tell you, especially if they're true Iranians, they're going to tell you, I'm Persian. Don't call me Iranian, I'm Persian. But when we come back after the break, I want to talk about this idea of what would make this a successful protest. I mean, what would be a good outcome for this? And also, what could nations do specifically to help support those people in Iran to find some change in the Iranian government? So we'll be right back. You're listening to Beyond the Matrix here on Israel News Talk Radio.
Israel News Talk Radio, straight talk from Israel.
Shalom from the heartland of Israel. This is David Ha'ivri. Join me every Tuesday at 5 p.m. Israel time, 10 o'clock Eastern, for A Hebrew in the Heartland on Israel News Talk Radio. Hear the news and views from the heartland of Israel every Tuesday at 5 p.m. Israel time. Be there.
Welcome back to Beyond the Matrix, here on Israel News Talk Radio.
We're back from the news break. Thank you so much for joining us. We'd like to hear from you. If you'd like to email us or email me, rod@israelnewstalkradio.com, rod@israelnewstalkradio.com. We'd love to hear from you. We have a very interesting subject that we're talking about today. We're talking about the Iranian protest. And right before the break, we're talking about what the United States could do to show its support. I'm not sure that we really did anything verbally to get behind this protest. And I'm not really sure why. Maybe you can provide a little commentary. But there are some active things that we could do to help encourage the average citizen of Iran to step up and think about regime change.
Well, I mean, the things that we did this time that we didn't do under Obama was to make an appeal for these ordinary Iranians, essentially to keep up a level of protest against the regime. We got it from both President Trump and a couple of his more clear tweets and stuff from somebody who I'm going to have a lot of respect for. That's U.S. UN Ambassador Nikki Haley.
Mm-hmm.
But the things that the U.S. has not done, as I indicated just before we went off the first segment, was that we need to reform, redress, and recreate a more effective Farsi or Persian language service for the Voice of America.
Mm-hmm.
We just have not done it. It requires, frankly, new leadership to be appointed by the White House over both the Voice of America, Radio Liberty, and its various language services. That's one thing. The other that we haven't done is something that we did during the Cold War, and that is to set up dissident groups from within the minority, essentially, inside Iran, some of whom, like the Kurds and the Baluchs, have engaged in actual resistance against the central government, against the Revolutionary Guards.
Mm-hmm.
We haven't done that. And we also haven't put some more screws, I hate to use that expression, but put some more screws on the question of telling others not to consider making direct investments in Iran until they clean up their act. For example, the Airbus folks, you know, have a great thing going, allegedly on assembling aircraft they're going to ship from the United States, by the way, to possibly Iran.
Mm-hmm.
And the French in particular have gotten very cozy. They've signed a whole bunch of agreements with the Iranians. And their big auto company, Peugeot, as it's called, had a banner year this year, past year, primarily because it could
sells.
Go back to its traditional market in Iran.
Right.
So you want to heighten the risk for foreign direct investment until we see dramatic changes that would benefit the folks on the ground out there, the average worker bee, so to speak.
Right.
So those are the things in the back of my mind that I've reflected on that perhaps others in the policy community might address that could do something, both here in the United States and in Israel, because, as I said before, Israel's Farsi language service is by far the most listened to of any of the foreign language services in Iran.
Mm-hmm. Which surprised me. I had no idea. The question that I have is, do you think it's possible to have a successful regime change without a lot of bloodshed?
No. I think the tenacity of these Shia supremacists, that's the only thing I can call them, the Ayatollah and the Mullahs, you know, they basically have stolen the country's provenance and stuffed their own pockets with these religious foundations that the Ayatollah, as supreme ruler, has set up. And the IRGC owns a whole bunch of companies. It's almost analogous to what the People's Liberation Army has done in China,
right,
who owned a whole bunch of businesses.
Right.
You've got to change that. If you can't change that, then you're going to have a lot of blood on the water and on the ground.
Well, I mean, I know that what has been a big benefit for change in the world in the last, say, 75 years has been especially the socialist countries, Russia and China, realizing that communism has not worked and that free markets at some level, whatever they can support, a free market system and an economic system that's sort of capitalist based, is about the only way to really prosper. Because I think what they realize is that after stuffing your pocket, you can only stuff your pocket with wealth that is coming from a source that has more wealth. You know, I don't know. That has been a positive thing in the world we're living.
That is, in fact, going on. Now we're in, the seventh year of the infamous Arab Spring?
Mm-hmm.
You notice the protests have grown elsewhere, like we had them in Tunisia this past week.
Right.
And arrests and protests there and attacks on Jews in Tunisia.
Mm-hmm.
And it's because their Islamist economic government that replaced an autocrat didn't deliver for the ordinary people.
Right.
So it's not only, you know, the socialist notion of it, it's the Islamic principles of economy that have failed.
I'm not really sure how the Islamist economy works. I mean, is it a socialist-based system or what?
Well, it is in part. I mean, the big thing is so-called Sharia finance and doctrine in terms of how they handle things like interest. They capitalize dividends and things of that sort. But it's the logical thing that if you have a free market system, that it is the arbiter of how you allocate resources.
Mm-hmm.
They don't allocate resources that way, do they?
No.
They have a command economy just like the Soviets did.
Right.
That's the issue.
Well,
why they're failing.
Ultimately, that is probably going to be one of the greatest benefits of a society with the internet, the availability of information, that nations are going to turn around and realize, hold on a second, Israel is prospering. As a matter of fact, if you look at Israel and its economy compared to all the nations around it, it's in the stratosphere. And
well, that's right.
Doing
I mean,
well.
That's, take a look at what happened this weekend. A big state visit on the part of Netanyahu with the premier of India, and who's putting in a big show for him. And they've already signed 9 or 10 agreements that he's going to be taking away in less than 4 days.
Now, these agreements are major economic agreements. I mean,
they're defense agreements. They're going to be revisiting the shipping of the so-called spike or standoff distance missiles that Israel uses against Syria, for example. And there are also cultural agreements as well.
Right.
And stuff that happens to deal with what Israel has been good for, and that means the startup economy.
What do you think explains the spike in the love affair between Netanyahu and India?
Oh, I think it's the fact that Prime Minister Modi, who's an Indian nationalist, a Hindu nationalist, realizes that what he tried to do in his home province of Gujarati by focusing on a less state-supported economy and fostering entrepreneurship, mm-hmm. essentially was the way to go in terms right. of the economic future for everybody in the country.
Which goes back to what we were talking about earlier, that the economy is going to drive change. I really do believe that. I mean, back in the day before information technology, change usually was brought about by major warfare and invasion and taking people's possessions and money, etc. Nowadays, I think people realize, and hold on a second, the average guy, if you can empower him to make his own way and empower him to have the ability to make money, society as a whole is lifted up to a higher level.
That has been the model that the West has created. And then subsequently, it took, you know, at least 150 years, in my knowledge, to have that eventuate in the rest of the world. I mean, the Indian economy underneath the Nehru family, remember those guys? Mm-hmm. They were pro-Palestinian.
Right.
Right? Right. And they had basically a socialist economy, and it was going nowhere.
Right.
And it was really the entrepreneurial revolution that occurred with the advent of technology.
Right.
That basically was the spark plug. And that's why they so appreciate what Israel, which is a fraction of their population,
right.
you know, what is it, 8.5 million versus 1.3 billion, has been able to do.
And I think that we're going to slowly see this shift also toward Africa, because we see a lot of interest being promoted between African states and Israel. And we're going to see the same kind of thing where they realize, here we have had an economy, we have the greatest resources in the world, and yet we are still in the same economic situation we've been for 200 years. There's got to be a change, and I think that they're beginning to see that. We're running close to the end of the time. Before we get to the end, next break, I would like to talk about the Kurds. Really important. I think we need a Kurdish update. This whole thing between the Kurds, Erdogan, you know, what is actually going to happen? Are we going to see a state of Kurdistan come up in the future? And that's going to be an interesting subject to chat about.
Yep.
So do you have anything you want to say before we go to the break?
Yeah, I do. You know, we're at a tipping point in Syria because the Kurds have demonstrated their ability, working with the U.S. coalition, to occupy a fairly significant portion of what was the obvious failed mm-hmm. state of Syria at this right. juncture. And there's a war going on between Erdogan on the one hand and the Russians on the other mm-hmm. in terms of whether or not the Kurds in Syria, as against what happened in the fall in Iraq, can really eventuate in some form of a Kurdish autonomy region in Syria proper.
I think it's a long time overdue. If we can find that. Okay, we're going to go to break. Thank you so much for listening. We'll be right back after these messages. You're listening to Beyond the Matrix here on IsraelNewsTalkRadio.com.
I'm Elizabeth. I'm from Stanton, California, and I love listening to Israel News Talk Radio.
Hi, I'm Andy from Augsburg, Germany, living now in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. When I want to get the news from Israel, I listen to Israel News Talk Radio.
Hi, I'm Leo Yuwono from Indonesia, and I love listening to Israel News Talk Radio.
Hi, I'm Carlton Letala from Zimbabwe, and I always listen to Israel News Talk Radio.
My name is Atira.
And I'm Bela Singer from Efrat, Israel, and we love listening to Israel News Talk Radio for the best information on Israel and the Jewish nation.
Hello, this is Mudaz Iran, leader of the Jordanian Opposition Coalition from Jordan. As an Arab, I enjoy listening to Israel News Talk Radio for the most updated news about Israel and to follow peace with our friendly neighbors.
You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio.
Welcome back to Beyond the Matrix here on Israel News Talk Radio.
back for the final segment. I'm Rod Bryant. Thank you so much for listening to Beyond the Matrix, and thank you for making Beyond the Matrix the show that it is. I really appreciate the time that we get to spend each week talking about everything from religion to politics, and now we're talking about strategic information about protest in Iran. And on this last segment, I would like to delve in a little bit on the Kurds, what's happening there, and what is the possibility of a Kurdish nation or state to be recognized officially?
Okay.
Okay. You're taking a break. We're actually in a show. You know that.
Oh, well, you can edit this out, but
we don't edit the mistakes out. We want people to realize
we basically have to face the reality that what would have been an independent Kurdistan in Iraq failed in this fall, and it was gobbled up by Iran and a combination of its goons, essentially, in Iraq. And this week I see they're coming to some sort of agreement to let them fly in and out of Erbil these days, which is wretched. Mm-hmm. But they lost Kirkuk. Now we have an opportunity because of what the U.S. coalition did by backing up the Syrian Democratic Force, now occupying a significant slice of the northeast of Syria. And there's been debate going on between members of the same coalition, meaning the Russians and the Turks, about giving auspices for a version of an autonomous region inside Syria for the Kurds. And there's an event coming up on the 29th and 30th in Sochi at which there's going to be a discussion about that aspect of a possible deal to end the civil war, which I don't think is going to be realized.
Well, I think Russia also wants them involved in those talks, correct?
That's correct. Yeah, Russia seems to feel, unlike Erdogan, who wants to strangle them, Russia seems to feel that they have a stake in the game. They've earned it. They have a chip in the game, as we say in this regard.
Right.
So there could be the auspices of doing that. On the other hand, the question is that going to be permitted and become a reality? The only stake the U.S. has announced is creating a so-called border security force for the Kurds, which will probably take years, but they are projecting a force of about 30,000. They could be retreads from the mixed Kurdish, Syrian Christian, and Arab force that liberated Raqqa and Deir ez-Zor in that regard. So that's one aspect of it. But the bad actor in all of this is Erdogan. Erdogan has become the other hegemon in the Middle East, and now, as we learned last week, you know, got the gift of a Red Sea island to build a naval base, courtesy of Sudan's President Bashir, and that has frosted al-Sisi in Egypt.
Right.
To the point that he's transferred troops with the assistance of the UAE to, of all places, Eritrea, and they closed the borders between Sudan, Eritrea, and Ethiopia over the course of the last week. Now its support had been temporized. But the bad actor in all of this is Erdogan, who's Muslim Brotherhood. He supported Hamas. He's given safe haven, essentially, for Muslim brothers from Egypt and also Hamas. But he's also connived with Bashir in Sudan to foster the overthrow of adjacent governments in Libya, as well as in Chad and a couple of other places I could name.
Now, what is his connection, you think, with, not Bahrain, I'll think of it in a second here.
Qatar.
Right. What is his connection with Qatar?
Qatar has been, and always will be, Muslim Brotherhood.
Right.
We know they've supplied hundreds of millions of dollars of aid to Sudan to assist in its genocide in Darfur and other regions. We know that during the whole Benghazi episode, that with the CIA under John Brennan, the Qataris were shipping in arms to various places in West Africa. And more importantly, they were shipping weapons to via Turkey to Syria to support, quote, the opposition. So Qatar has been a bad actor in that regard. And it's also, as I indicated, provided a safe haven for some bad actors who are leaders of Hamas.
I just find it surprising that President Trump sort of gave them an attaboy this week. Or was it this week or last?
Oh, no, it was this week. He said, you know, congratulations on doing counterterrorism work. Well, you know, that basically was the same sort of communications language he did for President Bashir, who's another member of the Muslim Brotherhood in the Sudan.
I mean, do you think this is some type of ploy?
Do
you think this is some kind of ploy to develop a relationship? I mean, we also have to remember that is it possible that the mother, the Brotherhood, the Muslim Brotherhood that is in Qatar and in other places, they're doing operations. Is it possible that the mainline government doesn't know about? Is it possible? I don't know.
It's not possible. Okay. I mean, you know, look, the emir of Qatar is an autocrat. He doesn't have a constituent assembly that I know of. And the unfortunate part about it is he gave $1 billion, didn't he, to build the El Udeid air base that we had, you know, created over there to supposedly assist in the Middle East. And it was supposed to be, ironically, an antidote to the NATO base that had Sirlik up in Turkey.
Right.
And it's not being used effectively because of questions of the dispute between Saudi Arabia, the UAE, and Qatar, as we see it now.
Well, there has been a high level of operational, what do you call it, regional operations in Qatar for years, though.
Yes, there had been with the El Udeid base.
Right, but you're telling me that that's not being utilized like it used to be?
Well, it is being utilized only to the extent that it will be engaged in doing tactical and resupply work. But most of the air missions the coalition has been carrying out have been done over, I think, in Abu Dhabi or UAE.
Right. We also have this sort of interesting alignment or allies that have come up with Saudi Arabia, Israel, Egypt, nations that before either were silent, didn't say too much about it, or just absolutely was in opposition to Israel, now saying that they would come in and align themselves with Israel if something happened with the Palestinians. I mean, I just find it amazing, shocking, and at the same time, I'm scratching my head. What do you think about this?
Well, I mean, to the extent that we can exchange intelligence with them, Israel can supply them with weaponry and training, that's fine. But the big breakthrough will be on the question of dropping their veil, so to speak, on the question of pushing for a peace deal with the Palestinians. I mean, look what happened this past weekend. You had Abbas who basically said, kiss off Israel. We're reverting back to our Holocaust denial roots acceptance of a Jewish state.
But in reality, all of the threats that Abbas has handed Israel in the past few months with the embassy in Jerusalem, et cetera, and also cutting funding for Hamas, nothing's really changed. This is the same kind of BS that we've seen for 60 years. I mean, for crying out loud, really? Well, they're going to deny it? Is that going to hurt our feelings now? They've been doing that anyway.
The one credit I have for Trump is the fact that he at least has realized that if you don't cut back on a money flow, these guys and gals won't do anything.
Right, of course.
And you saw what happened with the UNRWA, you know, first quarter donation of $125 million. They cut it back to $65 million. Already a lot of people on the ground in these 32 refugee camps across those areas are concerned about where their next flour bag is coming from.
Right.
On top of the fact that they basically being fed education in the form of anti-Israel and anti-Semitic hate. Then the next thing that has to happen is we have, who is it, Vice President Pence who's
coming
to Israel
this week.
Supposed to bring something with him. The best thing he could bring with him, assuming it could be done, is the enactment, meaning the signing into law the Taylor Force Act.
Now, tell everybody who Taylor Force was, because it's
going to be really important. Force was a U.S. Army military academy, a serving officer in Iraq and Afghanistan, who in March of 2016 was knifed to death at a seaside restaurant in Jaffa,
right,
in Israel. He was there as a graduate student from Vanderbilt's School of Management. He was checking out, you know, how the startup economy works. And this is the benefit he gets out of Palestinian terror. So what we now have realized is that the PLO for years has been taking foreign donation
right.
monies from the U.S. and a bunch of others and essentially paying off imprisoned
right.
Palestinian terrorists and their families to the tune of, what was it, $350 million
right.
last year.
So if Pence is really going to come with a bite, that's what he needs to bring, is to say, not only are we going to cut back your aid, but we're also going to seriously affect your ability to continue this craziness in which you're supporting terrorist families or terrorists themselves. Look, we're getting ready to run out of time. We got to tease this real quick. In a couple of weeks, or maybe next week, we'll see, Jerry Gordon and I are going to be sitting down and we're going to be talking about an inside look into the tactical operations that go on in fighting terrorism. And I think it's going to be an amazing. We're doing a lot of really good research so that you can understand that this is not some World War II movie. This thing is high tech and it's also highly regulated, in which ethics and morality is a huge, huge bearer. A barrier to doing anything unethical on the battlefield. So we have a great show lined up for you. Jerry, why don't you tell everybody shalom and we'll see you guys next week.
Shalom, y'all.
Y'all. Okay.
If you love Israel News Talk Radio, then you'll love our Facebook page. We keep you up to date on what's happening in Israel, plus little surprise treasures that we don't share on the radio. Go now to follow us on Facebook. Just look for the Israel News Talk Radio Facebook page, and don't forget to subscribe and follow us by clicking on the like button. We post great stuff there that you'll want to share. Israel News Talk Radio on Facebook and Israel News Radio on Twitter.
If you're hearing this message, everyone else can too. Advertise with Israel News Talk Radio and get your message out to people. We'll build a personalized package for you. Contact advertising at israelnewstalkradio.com.
Straight talk from Israel.
You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio.
News, opinion, and more.
You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio.